Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Vice and Brent 2020, London Borough of Culture, this is Vent Documentaries. Young people from one London borough telling you the stories we care about. This is series one, where we're talking about identity. I'm Amelia. I grew up in Brent, a really diverse borough in London. Then, 2 years ago, I moved from Brent to Surrey, a small quiet town outside London. And I was outnumbered by white people for the first time.
So we're now in Guildford, which is in Surrey. My producer Jess has come to visit. So we're just going to go on a quick whistle-stop tour around Surrey. So this is the station.
I came to Surrey for uni, and life as I knew it changed. Shops close at 6 p.m. The bus drivers are white, and everything's uphill.
So we're now along, just like we're coming near the high street. So we have one of the clubs called Pop World, which is really, really shit.
My friends are different now too.
Hey, I'm Breeze. I'm 21, and I work with Amelia at Topshop.
I love Breeze. She's one of those people you meet and just vibe with. Breeze is white and grew up in a village just outside Surrey. Our life experiences are mad different.
I grew up in Brent, which is a borough in London, and it's really culturally diverse. I was around all races, all different types of people. Yeah, when I came to Surrey, it was like, wow. What about you? What's it like?
Mine's the like
growing up in Surrey.
So especially because I live in Ash. Yeah. That's a village. Like there's a train station, that's about it. Mostly white people. There's a lot of like the traveller community in Ash.
Wow.
Yeah. Like my school that I went to was pretty much half travellers and then half like not travellers.
So like, when you were growing up generally in Ash, like was race something that kind of bothered you? Did you think about it?
Yeah, no, not definitely nothing that bothered me, not really anything I thought about. I didn't really know how much of like a problem like racism was either. So I was like more like naive.
Do you think it's because like you didn't have anyone or many people in like that area who were of like a completely different race to you?
Yeah,
so you just didn't really like have to see it? It
was
outside out of mind kind of
thing. Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, that's
yeah. What it is.
Because of the amount of cultures and stuff like that, and religions as well, in London, like you'd hear about a lot of things to do within the workplace, especially like with like institutional racism or like the prison system and the justice system as well. And crimes and things like that were often associated to people of a minority ethnic background. We kind of had a sense of what racism was really, really young. So for me, like primary school years was when I was like figuring out race and stuff like that. Like when my mum would say to me things like, be careful, and I'm like, I'm five, like what am I being careful for? So I think it was so different for us.
That's
growing
so crazy.
Up yeah, it's like kind of all we know, whereas it's so weird for me to think like people who don't live in London like just have no idea, but they're like almost like in ignorance,
in
a level of ignorance, but it's kind of blissful. I say like, it's like a bittersweet, like they're kind of just chilling, they have no idea what's going on. Like,
so what is it like for you coming to Surrey and like being pretty much surrounded by like white people?
When I first came, I was excited obviously to get away from like the business of London, because life was like really hectic. So I came to uni, and because they have like societies like the ACS, which is the African Caribbean Society, I thought, oh cool, like that's fine. But then I got on my course and I do English Lit. Yeah. With creative writing, literally I'm one of four black people in my course, because like, not that I felt any kind of anxiety around white people, but I just thought there's literally no one else that I can relate to. And I was like, whoa, like this is like more intimidating than I thought it would be. Like, I didn't think it was that deep until I actually got in the situation. And it kind of affected like things like group work and stuff like that. Like, I wouldn't necessarily be people's first option to be chosen because they like made their friends so much sooner and they have different things in common and stuff like that. Like, even just down to like different lingo, yeah. I'd be like, well, I don't even know how to talk to you.
Oh,
yeah, no, it was really weird. Like, yeah, it was a lot. It was a bit overwhelming, actually. I felt like I had to go out of my way to maybe change how I spoke. That just body language or seem more interested in what they're talking about, even if I really didn't give a shit.
Yeah, like, to like make it easier.
Yeah, just to make it easier for me so that we can get the work done. Mm. So it was like, I need to like maneuver myself. Like, it was hard. It was really hard, to be honest.
God.
Talking to Breeze, I kind of realised that a lot of the discomfort I was feeling being around white people was at my university. Working at Topshop, everyone there is white too, but I still feel on a level with them. Race doesn't play a huge part on our friendships in the way I thought it would. Why is it that at uni, I feel so aware of my race?
I went to uni like over 20 years ago now.
I wanted to know if it's just me who feels like this, or if loads of people feel the way I do.
I'm Nikesh Shukla. I am an author, screenwriter, and I'm so much older than you.
Nikesh grew up in Brent, like me. He was the first person in his whole family to go to uni.
It's not like anyone could sit me down and go, listen, Nikesh, this is what you got to look out for at university. And you know, there's this sort of stereotype of like, oh, all the Asian people know each other, all the black people know each other. And it's because like when you arrive in a space and you kind of don't know people and you do that minority head nod, then you just end up being friends. And so you kind of all do know each other. And so like, it is sort of that stereotype that we all know each other is sort of true, but it's sort of because of a self-defense mechanism.
Nikesh said that this discomfort that he and I have felt at being outnumbered by white people is super common.
Whenever I meet, and I'm using this as a purposefully silly term, whenever I meet unicorn ethnics who are like people who are from minority backgrounds who are like the only one in the school or in the village or in the town and whatnot, they just seem so beaten down by that experience that they've either had to kind of hide their true selves, or the presence of another person who looks like them makes them uncomfortable. And that's always kind of a weird thing to see. There's an amazing writer called Carl Anker who wrote a piece for BuzzFeed about 5 or 6 years ago, where he basically wrote a letter to his brother on going to university, and like it was his 10 rules for basically like how to cope with how hard it is being black in those spaces.
One, a lot of the world isn't built with you in mind. Two, many people will have never met someone who looks like you before. Three, this means you're going to get judged a lot. Four, based on what they've seen on screen, you owe Will Smith a thumbs up. Five, and maybe a slap. Six, you'll get offended, but don't forget, and you'll often choose to let it slide. Unfortunately, both barrels. It takes time to learn eight, when you're allowed to get angry about things. But even when it's the correct time, you'll sometimes get slapped down anyway. Nine, everything I've told you very much sucks. Ten, and I'm very sorry for that. Things are getting better, and I have the utmost faith in you.
It was one of the best online essays I've ever read, and it's something that I like referred to quite a lot because it was so beautiful and it was so honest, and it was also so vulnerable and brittle, and you could tell with each sentence and each bit of advice that all of this advice was, I experienced this and I had to kind of learn the hard way how to recalibrate. This is how you don't have to suffer as badly as I did.
I always argue it's more about how people respond to you rather than how you respond to them.
Yes.
That's the big thing.
This is Winston Morgan, reader in toxicology and clinical biochemistry, and director of impact and innovation of his school at University of East London. Winston studies the relationship between race and university grades. It's not good.
Basically, the percentage of BME students, particularly black students, attaining a good degree, a 2-1 or a first, are significantly less.
Between 15 and 30% less than white students. That's called the BAME attainment gap.
Although now we're trying to change that name from the attainment gap to the university awarding gap. And the reason we've done that is because if you say the attainment gap, you're saying it, the degree you get is solely down to the student's efforts and ability. Whereas when you think of the awarding gap, you're basically thinking it's really less about the student's ability and effort and more about what the university, if you like, the environment the university awards the student.
These facts aren't new. People have been talking about the BAME attainment gap, or now the BAME awarding gap, for decades.
The first thing they did was they adopted what we call a student deficit model. Interventions to sort of help students with academic skills and belonging, because they thought that was the reason why there is an awarding gap, because the, you know, students don't have the academic skills, particularly Black students, to be at university, which is wrong. So people tend to say, right, it must be because they didn't come in with the right qualifications, or they didn't have the right background.
The research shows that what actually happens is...
To get into Russell Group University as a BME student, you generally have to score higher. But when you leave, you're still going to end up with, if you like, an awarding gap.
I just had to deep that for a second. Black students often have to get better grades than their white peers to get into top-level universities. But then, statistically, they're probably going to leave with a worse degree mark. It takes the piss. Despite all this evidence, a lot of Winston's time is still spent trying to convince other academics that the BAME awarding gap is a real thing and the onus needs to be on them to fix it.
When academics say, oh yes, we do anonymous marking and that kind of thing, by the time the assessment has been done, it's too late. So yes, the anonymous, you don't have to be biased by the time you mark, because the bias took place in the lecture, in the support that you gave, the feedback that you gave, that kind of thing. Mm. But the focus now is definitely switching to what is the university doing to ensure that their staff are well trained and they're assessing BME students in the appropriate way.
Our university actually tried to do that with these like focus groups. So they actually targeted just Black students to come and sit and speak for about an hour with like the chair or the board of directors when it comes to the student union. And it was so good, like, to be so filterless and honest about maybe like the lack of support for us.
So what they really need to do is also then meet with the academics. What they're effectively doing is asking you to solve the problem, but the problem isn't really with you. It's with, as I said, the people who are teaching you and supporting you. Sometimes academics don't even realise they're doing it. Sometimes they may feel it's easier to talk to student X than to talk to student Y. So, and also, I mean, there was one sort of really good study about BME students tended not to go and see their lecturers outside the classroom, whereas white students did.
Yeah.
It is true, but the suggestion was it was the student's fault. Going back to this awarding gap thing, you didn't do what you should have done. You didn't go and see your lecturer. And the reason students tend not to go to see their lecturers is because they believe they won't get the support, or the lecturer won't be welcoming, or whatever, for whatever reason.
And have you have you ever spoken to any like of your Black students, for example?
I never speak to Black students. I'm only joking. Yeah, you'd be surprised how few students actually know about the awarding gap.
But I think it would be wise to like advise that there is a chance that you might actually not achieve to the way that you'd want to work.
No, but you see, even you've just used that language. You're saying that you may not achieve. There's a possibility that you may not be awarded at the level you should be awarded. It's a complicated one.
It's just, are you going to be recognised for your achievements accurately?
Yeah.
But do you feel as though the awarding gap actually continues beyond education, so like in the workplace as well?
Well, yes, as I said, because we live in a racialised world, all the awarding gap is a reflection of this racialised world we live in, where people assume that based on your phenotype, your physical characteristic, how you're able to think, how you're able to work in a social situation, all of those racialized things are linked. So whether you're in the university or in the workplace, those things will continue.
That's next.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more.
That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We're back.
My dream job basically is just to continue being a presenter and go into like broadcast journalism as well.
What I'm trying to do is stretch culture enough that we can all kind of find the versions of ourselves that we want to exist in it.
Nikesh Shukla.
Never be told, oh, this is too niche or this isn't relatable or all the rest of it, because my answer to all of that is relatability is white privilege and all the rest of it.
Nikesh had this one class at uni which shaped how he treats his career as a writer. He studied law and had a module on human rights.
And it completely changed my life. I saw the world in a new light. I saw the world through the lens of thinking about others rather than thinking about me and making money and doing this and for all the wrong reasons. And it just made me realise that actually what I wanted to do was help people.
As the first person in his family to go to university,
I was shown what opportunities that people who are in those sorts of environments can have. And that was really, really interesting because it made me then go, well, actually, I want to use that opportunity to kind of help other people, help my community, help the people who didn't have the opportunities that I have.
So, when he left uni, Nikesh started developing as a writer, but promised himself he'd only work for charities and non-profits while he was waiting in the wings.
I was a youth worker for a long time. I was working on a magazine in Bristol and I was mentoring a bunch of writers. An editor once said to me, oh, I love your writing. I love its energy, but could you apply this energy to a story about a rural detective? And I nearly did it. I nearly wrote a rural detective novel, but it would have been terrible because what do I know about rural detectives?
Nikesh stayed true to himself.
You know, I was mentoring Liv and Varidza and Antonia when they were setting up Galdem. And out of all of that work, I was just like, what can I do in literature that's sort of similarly minded? And that's when The Good Immigrant happened.
A fucking great book that Nikesh edited. 21 essays by Black, Asian and minority ethnic writers from across Britain working in literature and the media.
And once The Good Immigrant was a success, and if it hadn't been a success, this would be a different conversation. But because The Good Immigrant was a success, no one can tell me what to do now, because I have shown that I can bring an audience, and ultimately the best thing for me to do is what I want to do. That's been really, really freeing for me.
But you can't restructure a whole industry with one book. Even though Nikesh is helping push against the structural racism he sees every day in his job, his own success doesn't automatically change things for everyone.
The thing that I noticed when I did The Good Immigrant, I did The Good Immigrant as a community building thing, but I noticed that all the opportunities kept coming to me. And I realised that actually that was just how dull the industry is that they see a book, they see books be successful, and they're just going to go, OK, first we're going to go to Reni Edo Lodge, then we're going to go to Akala, then we're going to go to Nikesh. Like, it's like I'm number three in the range of no's. Let me tell you how many times I was asked to go on TV and be a public intellectual commentating about the Windrush generation. And I'm like, obviously, immigration is a huge topic and it's very important to me and my family. But there are people who are, you know, this is their community and those are the people you should be speaking to. And so my rule always became, who are five people who I can suggest? Who are five women of colour who I can suggest who can do this? So I would never say no. I would always say, I can't do this, but here are five people who you should speak to. And that was my way of just going, you can never tell me you don't know where the talent is ever again. We have to support each other. We're not in competition with each other. And we've been pitted against each other for the longest time by there only being allowed to be one. And now we can have more than one. Let's all work together to have as many ones as possible.
I can't help but notice that Nikesh is describing a situation where it's people of colour doing all the work to create opportunities for each other and make sure everyone is represented, while the probably mostly white producers of these new segments and other things are doing the bare minimum.
And the thing about holding people to account is you kind of go, well, what is your long-term strategy? Because we've been talking about this for 20 years and we keep talking about these sort of short-term solutions, but what is your long-term strategy so that in 20 years' time you're not asked this question again? That's how you need to think about it.
I needed to speak to someone whose actual job is to have a long-term strategy for addressing issues of diversity in the media. So I spoke to Bob Shannon.
He's the managing director of the BBC and the person who's ultimately responsible for diversity and inclusion within the organisation.
What would you like to know from me?
I started by asking Bob about his career and how he ended up in such an influential position.
I mean, I've actually worked at the BBC for a long time and in media for a long time. So when I finished at uni, I started working in a local commercial radio station.
Yeah.
I started in that and then I went to the BBC and I worked in the sports department for a long time. I had a whole great career working in sport and I was head of sport for the BBC.
Oh, wow.
Running
okay.
TV and radio. So, I mean, just great fun. And then I spent the next 7 years running Radio 5 Live. That was great fun. Then I left the BBC for a year.
Okay.
And I went to Channel 4. And then I came back to the BBC because it needed to have a new person running Radio 2 and 6 Music.
Right.
And I fancied it.
Bob went from the world of sport to the world of music until about 3 years ago when...
I was given another job running all of radio, not just Radio 2 and 6 Music, all of BBC Radio and all of BBC Music until just over a year ago. And a year ago, I was appointed to be the managing director of the BBC, kind of running the BBC, which is why probably the issue of inclusion and diversity has become really, really prominent in my working life, because this is the first time I've had to think about the whole of an organisation.
So then I kind of want to get into the nitty-gritty of it, if you don't mind. Do you know your like statistics of diversity at the BBC currently?
Yeah, broadly. For us, you know, diversity has a number of different forms and we have a number of protected characteristics that we consciously monitor in the organisation.
Right.
And one of which, of course, is the makeup of the ethnicity of our teams.
Where do you see the greatest amounts of diversity? Do they like tend to be in the lower paid roles and jobs, or is it kind of mixed within the higher jobs as well at the BBC?
No, your instinct there was right. If we're talking about ethnic diversity, just for a second now, we do relatively well at the sort of entry level. Within BBC Radio, we've got a BBC Asian network and we've got Radio 1 Extra. Those stations tend to have quite young people and they tend to be at the beginning of their career journey.
Mm.
Our biggest challenge is when those people have completed their first cycle of work in the BBC.
Yeah, do they stay on or...?
Do they stay? My worry would be that too many people look around the BBC and think, oh, hang on a minute, I don't feel this isn't... this organisation might not be for me. They're amongst the first to go. We need more BAME senior leaders.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest challenges for the BBC is at socioeconomic diversity.
Yes.
It's a very middle-class organisation.
Yeah.
Bob knows that the BBC is a very white, middle-class place. And even though they have schemes aimed at bringing in diverse talent, there are problems with retaining people like me when we do come to work there. But he says the organisation is changing.
I'd just take you back to last autumn. You may remember there was a big story about the BBC apparently reprimanding one of our presenters for speaking out of turn about Donald Trump. It was the presenter, Naga Munchetti.
Oh, yeah, no, I do actually think...
There was a big storm about it.
Yeah.
The reason I mention it is because actually the Director General of the BBC overturned that decision and said,
right.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was quite an interesting indicator. And what it did was it was like a cold bucket of water into the corporate face of the BBC to make us realise that we still got a lot of work to do to make sure that the BBC feels truly inclusive.
I hear this. But also, I don't know why it took this particular incident to be the cold bucket of water on the BBC. The organisation has lacked diversity from the beginning. So I don't know whether to feel encouraged by what Bob is telling me or disheartened that for all the talk about diversity, people of colour are still underrepresented and don't always feel welcome there.
I know that I've kind of mentioned quite a few times that I'm like constantly having to think about my identity in terms of work and being taken seriously as a Black woman. Do you feel like that's any different to your experience? And do you feel like your identity necessarily played a part in like the jobs that you managed to secure for yourself and just the way that your career has just kind of like gone on an upward spiral?
I think if you've grown up from a comfortable middle class background and you've been to Cambridge University and had some of the opportunities that I've had in my life.
Yeah.
I think what it probably does is it instills a sense of belief and that the opportunity is there for the taking.
Yeah.
You know, I think it would be ludicrous for me not to argue that those things have been an advantage for me. I kind of cling on to the hope that I've been quite good at some of the things that I've done as well. There are two obvious reasons why this is an important subject. One is because it's the right thing that we should do.
Right.
The other is because it makes sense in a modern media company that we should have people who reflect the people we're serving. That fact is so universally understood now. You know, there aren't any corners of the credible media and creative world that haven't embraced this.
I was always told that I was too much. I mean, it happens to Black British people again and again and again and again. The Black British people are incredible.
This is Gemma Kearney. She's a broadcaster who's presented on BBC Radio 1, Six Music, done documentaries, TV, started her own production company. She's a writer.
And a big, excitable puppy when it comes to life, even though I'm a grown woman.
She's basically an OG in the game.
That's so nice.
She's had the kind of career I aspire to. I was hoping she'd have some good advice for me as a Black woman who's been navigating the media industry for years.
I started when I was 23 and I didn't even really know that sexism and racism was as complex as it was.
Yeah. Did you ever feel like you were like treated differently based on the fact that you're a woman and also a woman of colour?
Oh, I was so excited when I first started.
Yeah.
I was also in a family because I started on One Extra. Trevor Nelson was my co-host. He was an amazing mentor.
Oh my gosh, Trevor Nelson.
I know. He was an amazing mentor to me. We instantly clicked. It was only a bit later, maybe a couple of years in, that I realised that suddenly a lot of my peers or a lot of my colleagues were male.
Mm-hmm.
There's been stuff like that I wouldn't say in a podcast, where you get treated really badly. But you build resilience, firstly.
Mm-hmm.
Your gut instinct gets stronger, so you know the types of people that may treat you like not very nicely. And use it for your fire.
Yeah, it just fuels the fire, innit? So how do you feel about like people really understanding, you know, like unconscious bias and the reality of like challenges that women of colour face within the business? Like, do you feel like the people like in power, like the big dogs basically, do you think it matters if they understand it or not? Especially like white men or white women who are above us as well.
Inside, in my heart, I think that it is important that people go on a journey to shift unconscious systemic racism.
Right.
You know, I don't think anyone could say that they haven't, you know, unconsciously like done something. Or, and I do think, especially if you are a white male at the top, etc., you probably stereotyped at least at one point. I went to the Sony Awards once, which it's like the Oscars of the radio world, and I'd been persuaded to wear blue lipstick.
Oh, gosh.
There had been a Beyonce video that had just dropped and she'd worn blue lipstick. I can't even remember what song it was. I turned up on Trevor's arm with blue lipstick and he was just like, "You're so weird."
Yeah.
I was like, "Where is your sense of fun?" You got to remember that the Sony Awards is a sea of mostly white men in black suits. Mm-hmm. A sea of balding heads. It's actually hilarious. And I'm in blue lipstick. Really young, really nervous. And I started to feel like an idiot. I was at a really fancy 5-star hotel. There were chandeliers everywhere. I looked up and on the table opposite me was a face that I was always really inspired by and quite in awe of. And it was Lauren Laverne. She just looked at me eye to eye from the table and just mouthed at me, "I love your lipstick. Like, you look amazing." Just that. It was just a moment where I was like, I am appreciated. Somebody gets it. It's okay to be different and push the boundaries. Mm-hmm. Just given that confidence to experiment and basically to be me. I think finding a mentor, whether you officialize it or not, isn't necessarily that important. But keep your eyes peeled for the people in an organization or a company that know how hard it can be. Mm-hmm. And that just give you a big up.
I had an interview not long ago with Bob Shannon from the BBC.
I know, Bob. Yeah.
I felt like, you know, the conversation went well. Obviously, he didn't necessarily answer all my questions directly, but he seemed really open to that idea that, like, there is still a lack of diversity.
I'm so glad that these conversations are happening.
Yeah, it's
and
true.
I'm glad that they're happening with a 20-year-old student and essentially one of my big bosses.
I actually want to go into, like, broadcast journalism. And as a Black woman, you know, it's just twice as hard to get half of what you want, really, especially in the world of media and, like, media that's dominated by white men, essentially. Mm-hmm. So I kind of really need to have these conversations in order to, like, just prepare for what I know is inevitably going to happen unless, like, drastic changes happen.
I am thinking at the moment the narrative can be different. The lid has been flipped. The stats are there. We exist. We still exist. We're still exactly. here. We, as women of colour, unfortunately, rather than inevitably, I want to say unfortunately right now in the present, have to work harder. Mm-hmm. And it's gutting. But the paradigm is changing. The path that we want to tread, particularly a career path, okay, doesn't have to be like anyone else's before us.
That's true.
Be prepared for those moments of adversity, but also listen to your gut. I'm excited for you. And if you like ever want to ask a question, drop me an email. And if I don't respond straight away, drop it again, right? I've got you.
Yeah.
We're not on the path alone.
A piece of advice I got really early on that has stayed with me all these years was that you're the first customer of anything you do. I really like that.
You've got to believe in yourself in terms of your drivers have to come from you and not other people determine, you know, who or what you can be.
Get in touch and send me some writing when you're ready. Don't feel like you have to send it to me like tomorrow, but like when you're ready, when you've got something that you're ready to share, I'm here.
Thank you for listening to Vent Documentaries. I'm Amelia. Vent Documentaries are produced by Jess Lawson and Arlie Adlington, with help from Amelia Gill, Mawid Majid and Kamaya Shea. Our music is from WMP Studios. I read quotes from Carl Anker's essay, 10 Things I Wanted My Little Brother to Know Before He Went to University, from BuzzFeedNews.com. That's CARLANKA. Vent is a collaboration between Vice and Brent 2020 London Borough of Culture.